So, lecture 15, March 8, lecture notes, page 129. Happy International Women's Day, if you're an international woman, or a domestic woman, or a woman of any kind. Happy day to you and yours. I did. Facial covering is still required, as you know, so wear them. So, anybody go down to the groundbreaking ceremony for the new college? Was anybody down there? 400 people there. That was pretty impressive, along with a lot of big donors. I was told there was going to be a protest. The protest was going to be because the university allowed unmasking. This was going to be a group that protested wanting them to mask. I said there was no way the university was going to win that. Either way, if they unmasked, then people would want them to mask. If they masked, then there'd be a protest wanting them to unmask. I didn't see anybody down there, so I guess they didn't protest. So, strangely timed, but I did send you an email. If you want to see this guy, the ambassador, Ambassador Crawford present in an entrepreneurship series, feel free to get up and walk out at 4:30 down to the Kiva. Stick around till 5:30 because you can always see this online, as you know. So if that interests you, feel free to attend that. If you're interested in knowing more about information systems, information technology, there's a Career Expo day, Thursday, March 10th, noon to 4:30 p.m. You don't have to be there the whole time. It's all online with these different areas where they'll have experts, alumni, business people talking about all those different areas. You can download a booklet at that link, which will be in the housekeeping slides in Canvas after the class. And if you want to go, you can sign up, and then you have to click the events tab and search for IT Expo and click on register, choose the available session to get to one of these. How many ISIT people are there? A couple? Anyone interested that isn't actually a major? Nah. All right. Extra credit number 4 closing Thursday, mini test 7 closing tonight. Midterm 1 is closed. Midterm grades are posted. Do you know if you can see your midterm grades? Is that something you can click? You can. All right, so you should be able to see, for my course, whatever it is I had posted for you. Yeah? Let me see. That closes Thursday. So far, those participated have added over 1% to their final course grade in either category of extra credit. So if you're right on that margin, man, that 1% matters. Congratulations. The midterm, we know that the average with the 5-point curve, 72.3%, 98% of the students took it, the others didn't. We know that mini test 7 closes. This I thought was amusing for me to do. You may not care. So since I have these questions asking, notes, book, both, I ran through and ran an average just real quick. So for students who said they had neither the book nor the notes, their average score on the midterm was 61%. I guess that's pretty good considering they didn't have the notes or the book. But average with the book only, 67%. Average with the notes only, 68%. The average for students that said they had both, and I assume they actually had them, used them, studied them, looked things up in them, 74%. I remind you, these are open book, open notes tests. A lot of people said they weren't using one, the other, or weren't using both, which explains one reason why the average isn't as high as it could be, because there are a bunch of people not participating fully. Okay, so business in the news. This is a combo, I think, again, of two stories. Large late merchandise orders are raising companies' inventory costs from an overall business viewpoint. Accounting majors, this is actually an accounting issue as well. The combination of big merchandise orders and lengthy shipping delays is tying up cash in supply chains, straining the finances of companies as they seek to cover the cost of goods awaiting to be delivered. So we're understanding inventory costs a little bit from a business viewpoint. This is pushing buyers and suppliers to extend their payment terms and obtain new financing that expands the cost of carrying inventory. The cash bind is particularly severe for small firms. So you're a small firm. You've got a limited amount of money, a bunch of it is tied up in inventory that hasn't arrived yet, and you're just sitting there. I got no money coming in, I got money out, what am I going to do? Obviously not as big a problem for businesses as small businesses. So supply chain and the cost of doing business. Physical inventory levels have been low since the early 2020, but the cost of holding inventory has increased sharply because goods have been stuck in supply chains for longer and longer periods. Additionally, some businesses have purchased extra inventory to meet the greater demand, as well as to replace or supplement those items that are not coming through the supply chain. All these factors contribute to higher inventory balances and expenses on the financial statements. So if you're a business, what are you going to do with all these increased expenses? You can only eat them for so long before you start losing significant profits. So you're going to next think about passing it on to the consumer, yeah? So that's going to take us to our next story. Many businesses are trying to pass those higher costs to customers through price increases. So this is part of price in the mix. But the need to do this sometimes leads marketers and business people to what I would call at best questionable, maybe deceptive behavior. So this is the related story. The hidden ways companies raise prices. Let us entertain you. Arc, 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 let us entertain you. A Chicago-based restaurant group has added a 3%, quote, processing fee to checks at many of its restaurants. Harley-Davidson added a charge last year to its motorcycles to cover costs, rising material costs. Peloton Interactive in January began charging $250 for delivery and setup of some of its indoor bikes, a service that was previously included for free. So, price in the marketing mix, and of course the influence of economic factors on marketing, the marketing mix, pricing the consumer. Companies are finding all kinds of ways to make consumers pay for rising costs. Often, this is the problem, that is not clearly reflected in the posted price, so the ethics of pricing. Consumers' costs can increase, or the value of their purchase can decrease, in a variety of ways, such as smaller package sizes, somewhat exaggerated up here where the package is still big, but the product is very small. Hotels that change sheets only between guests' visits, not daily like they used to. Theme parks, in fact, Disney, that cancel free airport shuttle. Auto dealers that require customers to buy a protective paint coating with a car, none of which is clearly and transparently known to the customer. They don't point it out to them. With supply chain challenges, pent-up demand in a tight labor market leading to inflation, businesses are looking for subtle ways to pass along rising costs. And my comment, subtle? Deceptive? Where's the line here? Consumer pressure has led some companies to back off added fees, including Frontier Group Holdings, the airline, which uses a la carte pricing that lets frugal travelers choose to forego an amenities. In May of 2021, added a $1.59 per flight segment COVID-related fee to cover the costs, additional costs of cleaning and cleaning supplies, etc. After consumer backlash, Frontier in June stopped breaking it out as a component of its base fare, but didn't stop charging it. So now it's just no longer broken out. It's just wrapped into your cost of the airplane ticket. I guess at least you know what the cost is. The Biden administration has begun to look into some forms of hidden fees, which it calls junk fees. The administration says that the amount of being charged is not always tied to the cost faced by the company providing the goods or services. So this is the impact of regulatory, legal, and political factors on business and the notion that bad business behavior does lead to consequences. So now we got government into the mix, which always leads us to more restrictions and legislation. Why not just behave well instead of badly? Yet to Stola Nietzsche. Anybody know Stola Nietzsche? However you say it, what it is? No? Vodka? So Stola Group has finally had enough after more than a week of boycotts and other protests against Stola Nietzsche. Am I saying that Stolidaya? How do you say that? Stolinaya? Anyhow, that brand name, it's Russian name vodka that's produced in Latvia. The company's renamed the brand is just Stoli. The impact of consumers on brands. I've said earlier when we talked about ethics, one of the ways to get things done is to boycott and protest. And then marketers will often pay attention. That's what they're doing here. Russian-born Yuri Scheffler, founder of Stoli Group, declared that he had been exiled 20 years ago due to my opposition to Putin. More than anything, I wish for Stoli to represent peace in Europe and solidarity with Ukraine. Stoli Group also cited the wishes of its employees, partners, distributors in Eastern Europe as a factor in its decision, with the global CEO, Damon McKinney, Stoli Group stating, "They are asking that we take a bold stand. This is one actionable, meaningful thing we can do to make it clear that we support Ukraine." So a bit of social responsibility in marketing, if you will. The cynics of you will say, not really. All they're doing is changing their brand name. How about they put money behind what they say? Funny you should mention that, because another action the company has taken is an unspecified financial commitment to the World Central Kitchen, a nonprofit providing meals to Ukrainians and refugees. So social responsibility in changing your brand name in response to the crisis, but also putting some money behind it. An unknown amount, I admit. Meanwhile, Smirnoff, I know how to say that, the world's vodka leader, which has faced boycotts and pressure similar to Stoli's, now declares on its U.S. homepage that it's proudly made in America. So this is building, of course, on their brand image. So this is the, you know, this is their live, yes. This is their live homepage. I'm not going to put in my ID. And it has proudly made in America on their homepage. Other vodka brands have taken their own stands on the Russian invasion of the Ukraine. Sweetgrass Vodka, whose taste of South Carolina is Polish-inspired, said it's donating $1 from every bottle sold to support humanitarian efforts in the Ukraine. Royal Wine, which sells X-Star Ukrainian vodka, and Lvov, a Polish vodka named after a Ukrainian town, will donate 100% of those brands' proceeds through March 10th to Emergency Ukraine with a minimum donation of $30,000. So again, social responsibility with some dollars. Then there's the brand new American Premier Vodka. On that little bottle, you can't really see it, but its brand name is American, termed a patriotic alternative to Russian vodka. It is set to launch on March 15th, and will give $1 from every bottle sold to the American Legion. It's an American brand, on whose 12,000 posts the brand will be sold, in addition to an online presence. So here's the introduction of a new product, competition in the marketplace, and of course a particular segment approach. We're developing an entirely new brand for Americans who want American vodka, so segmentation and target marketing. Finally, Gen Z. Gen Z watches nearly as much TV as they do short-term video, which is not the impression that many people have of Gen Z. Are Gen Z consumers watching only TikTok and other short-form videos? Have they abandoned watching traditional TV? We have to understand our consumer, our market, their media exposure habits. Far from it, according to Horowitz Research's new State of Gen Z 2021 report, some marketing research. In fact, 78% of U.S. 13 to 24-year-olds surveyed reported streaming shows, movies, sports, and other TV content weekly, compared to 79% who report streaming short clips, user-generated content, video game live streams, and videos on social media on a weekly basis. So we're trying to understand that segment's behavior relevant to what they watch. Across the full sample, share of viewing time is also fairly evenly split, with short-form video at 54%, long-form video at 46%. Short-form's share of time is a bit higher among the youngest Gen Zers, the 13 to 17-year-olds, compared to the older group and among males. The viewing share splits are also very similar across white, Latina, Asian, and black Gen Zers. A survey of 800 was nationally representative. The study included oversamples of Hispanic, black, Asian Gen Zers in order to make sure that they have an adequate sample. In addition, contrary to public belief, Gen Zers do watch on traditional TVs as well as smartphones. 6 in 10 say they have a TV set in their bedrooms. How about you? How many of you guys have a TV set in your bedroom at home or in wherever you live now? I'd say that's right on target with what you guys too? Yeah? I'd say that's right on target with the how many of you guys watch the TV occasionally that you have in your bedroom or whatever? Yeah, so it's not that you guys don't ever watch TV. It's important for marketers to keep in mind that media consumption, I always call it media consumption habits, you've heard me say that before, among Gen Z is not about absolutes. It is not true that they never watch long-form TV content, that they never use a screen other than their phones, or that they never watch live TV. Marketers need to know the media consumption habits of their consumers, their segment, their target audience. Understanding that there are nuances of Gen Z's media habits gives marketers and media brands the opportunity to increase engagement and create unique experiences for this generation of digital natives across multiple platforms and through a variety of formats as is appropriate for their group of consumers. Yeah? Okay. Lecture notes, page 129, page 250 in the textbook, continuing with STP, segmentation, targeting, and positioning. We return to that topic. So we had just finished up one approach to doing segmentation, and that was market aggregation, where we essentially create one marketing mix for everybody, lower cost and easy to manage. And I said there's another traditional approach to doing segmentation, and that is product differentiation strategy. So product differentiation involves using different elements of the marketing mix. What are the elements of the marketing mix? Product, price, place, promotion. Using different elements of the marketing mix, depending on who you're dealing with, to help consumers see the product as being different from the competition. Differentiation, and of course, better for that consumer than the competition is. So this is product differentiation as an approach to dealing with these different segments. So to create a perception that the brand is better than PCs, Apple has used a successful differentiation marketing strategy, talking about how their product is better than the competition for you, the consumer, for example. Within this, we can also talk about a single segment strategy or a concentrated strategy. So at the beginning, let me back up one because we... So the one approach is to aggregate one marketing mix for everybody, mass marketing or undifferentiated marketing. The second is this differentiated approach, different segments have different marketing mixes focused on them. And then we have single segmentation strategy or a concentrated strategy. Here we develop a marketing mix that target a defined group. It is a good way to avoid competition. Our example, which is probably overused by now, is the Hain Tea Group, focusing on those people that want organic teas, and that's their focus. They're not focused on every other segment of the tea market. Volkswagen, when it first came to the United States a long, long, long time ago, they made one car. Do you know what that was called in the day? What the nickname was? The Bug? Who's that? Who knows that? The Bug, the Beetle. Okay? And for a number of years, their big pride was you really couldn't tell the difference year to year. They didn't also have a pickup truck and a van. Over time they did, but initially, and a sporty version. They had one car appealing to the low-end market, period, which means they were not head-to-head in competition against Ford, Chrysler, Chevy, etc. Good strategy. But strategies change over time, and of course, eventually Volkswagen had a whole bunch of different sorts of models, each targeting a different market segment. So our business strategies change over time. Here we are niched, single segment, we know who we are, and then over time we may grow and change, okay? On the other hand, some car companies know who they are and stay there. So, for example, as far as I know, you cannot get a four-door Ferrari, a SUV Ferrari, a pickup Ferrari. As far as I know, Ferrari continues to concentrate on their original single-segment high-speed sporty cars. So, different approaches for different companies. So, what's an advantage of this single-segmentation strategy? The marketer can earn a reputation as an expert or a specialist in this niche market. So certainly when we think of high-speed, expensive, sporty cars, Ferrari may come to mind. They're an expert in the field. Probably not Volkswagen leaping to mind. Niche markets are often, though not always, relatively small compared to, well, lots of different markets. Anybody do paintball? Paintball used to be a thing, a bit of a thing. Not so much. So anyhow, if you're in the paintball market, you probably have heard of Spider. Spider, the paintball specialist. Spider, a passion for paintball. It's not over until the sun sets. Spider.tv. And so here we're going to find all things paintball related. Markers and low impact paintballs and paint guns, etc. All focused on that particular market segment. Now you could argue, I think properly, that, well, that's a sport, right? You think of any other sports companies maybe that don't focus on paintball. What's a sports company, sporting goods company that comes to mind? What is it? Dick's Sporting Goods. Okay, they're a retailer. How about a brand, big brand within their... Nike, Wilson, that sort of thing. So those guys cover a whole bunch of sports, right? So you can get a basketball, and you can get a baseball, and you can get a volleyball, Wilson products. These guys are not going against them. These guys have limited resources. They're a smaller company. They're not going to come up with spider skis, spider tennis rackets, spider volleyball nets. They're focused on one small segment in which they become experts. So if you're a paintballist, presumably, you know the spider name or maybe their parent company now. They were bought out, the Core Outdoor family of brands. All that is paintball. All right, so a niche market for these guys. Now, unfortunately, of course, particular segments come and go. So what happens if suddenly, due to all the violence in America, everyone turns their back on paintball, it's no longer a good idea? You're pretty well screwed. I mean, that's all you do. So my silly example here is putting all your eggs in one basket. Well, what happens if your egg falls and breaks? Anybody remember the World Football League? It's not here anymore. Anybody remember the DeLorean? No one remembers the DeLorean from, thank you, couple from Back to the Future. All your eggs in one basket, it's gone. Although I heard a rumor they're bringing it back, but not the main part of the story. How about Orbitz soda with all that little floaty stuff inside? God. So there is a danger of putting all your eggs in one basket with one niche for your focus. The market goes away. There's nothing left for you to do. But when you're a small company, you want to get a reputation as an expert in an area, it can be a good place to be. Another approach then is to say, well, wait a minute, I've spent all this time dividing up the market into different segments. This is the segment, vacation segment that wants beach, and this is the action vacation segment, and that's the pet vacation segment, and here's the cruise vacation segment. I did all that work to divide them up. What if I use my resources and development marketing mixes for a couple of these segments? So we do have an approach of multiple segmentation marketing. So we identify multiple segments, then we develop, market, and manage multiple marketing mix offerings, attempting to satisfy the needs, wants, and desires of each segment with a targeted marketing mix. And we joked last time that if you really wanted the beach, I probably couldn't get you involved in that action vacation, although my beach goer said, yeah, you could. But they have different needs, wants, and desires. So we developed different marketing mixes for them. One company that does that pretty well is the Bayer healthcare company. So Bayer markets Aleve, Midol, Bronchaid, Citrical, Esprina, Flintstones. What are some advantages of this? Well, obviously, if you are focused on paintball, I'm betting you don't do a big winter business. Paintballs get really hard when it's cold outside. What do you do then? Well, what if you did paintballs and tennis? Now you have a way to offset the seasonal demand issues. Dorm rooms, right? When is there not a huge demand for dorm rooms during the cycle? Summer, right? So what do? We still got expenses, still got to maintain them, still are paying on the mortgage or whatever the bond for them. But there's not a lot of student demand. Is there something we can do? What do we do? Anybody know what we do in the summer? Say again? Well, but that's not making any money. That's not helping us out. How about a niche you could use? Summer camps, summer band camps, summer soccer camps, summer baseball camp. Bring in a group of folks, have them in the dorms, have a program for them, and help have them pay. Offset that seasonal demand for it. So we have a different segment out there for them. Also, you can obviously become well-known in the product category as a leader. When you think aspirin and that sort of products, Bayer probably comes to mind. Disadvantages, well, it's expensive to have a whole bunch of different brands in different sizes, flavors, shapes, colors, channels of distribution, etc. So you have higher total inventory costs. You have to have adequate inventories of each style, color, shape, etc. You need have higher promotional costs. Each segment needs a separate appeal. The beach segment, the cruise segment, the adventure segment. Higher distribution costs if each of the segments shops in a different place. And therefore, you better be sure, if this is your approach, you've got strong sales to support all this extra work, all these extra costs. For example, it's estimated that it takes $100 million in annual sales to support each new version of Crest toothpaste that rolls out. And there are a lot of Crest toothpastes that roll out. You better have, I mean, that's a lot of tubes of toothpaste that it takes to support this segment that you've now developed the toothpaste for. So you have to be sure that you've done your research. Remember, we talked about the characteristics of a good segment. One of the things we talked about was size. Is it big enough in terms of demand, in terms of dollars? Can you reach it, et cetera? So you have to be careful with this. How many people know Urban Outfitters? Good, I hope so. So Urban Outfitters is a multiple segment strategy company. Urban Outfitters is a lifestyle retail company which operates retail clothing stores. It operates through two reportable business segments, retail and wholesale. The retail segment consists of Urban Outfitters, Anthropologie, Free People, Terrain, Leapstart, and Beholden Brands, whose merchandise is sold directly through stores, catalogs, call centers, and websites. The wholesale segment consists of Free People Division. It designs, develops, and markets young women's contemporary casual apparel. So, how are these segments different from one another? Urban Outfitters targets young adults, women and men, age 18 to 28, through unique merchandise mix, compelling store environment, websites, and mobile applications. The Anthropologie Group consists of Anthropologie, Beholden, and Terrain brands. Anthropologie's target market is women between the ages of 30 and 40 who are both affluent and individuals who want to reflect their unique style with what they wear. The brand goes beyond the surface and considers their target customer, our magic words, right, target market segment, as a friend. Beholden, the Beholden brand, emphasizes every element that contributes to a wedding. The brand offers a curated collection of heirloom quality wedding gowns, bridesmaid frocks, party dresses, assorted jewelry, headpieces, footwear, lingerie, and decorations. Beholden is your wedding friend. And Terrain. Terrain is designed to appeal to women and men interested in a creative and sophisticated outdoor living and gardening experience. Terrain's product offerings include lifestyle, home, garden, and outdoor living products, antiques, live plants, flowers, wellness, and products and accessories, clearly different than the wedding segment. And Leafsdorf at Anthropologie, artistic, timeless, and collectible. The Leafsdorf line is eminently wearable, bringing a modern dressmaker sensibility to life through fine fabrics and tailoring, ornamented with extraordinary details such as unique trims, vintage buttons, and beautiful linings. Who knew there were so many segments of the fashion industry? How about Free People? Targeted to young contemporary women, ages 25 to 30, a specialty women's clothing brand is a destination for bohemian fashion that features the latest trends and vintage collections for women who live free through fashion, art, music, and travel. Yeah, so to the extent that each one of these is a, Newly. Our subscription segment consists of the Newly brand, which is a monthly women's apparel subscription rental service. Anybody either themselves or know somebody who's doing the monthly rental service, you get shipped to one person? Okay, so you get this stuff shipped to you or family, whatever it is. You get to choose and keep what you want. It's curated to your taste because you've been in touch individually with the marketer. Is it Newly? Okay. Newly. For a monthly fee, Newly subscribers can select rental product from a wide selection of the company's own brands, third-party labels, and one-of-a-kind vintage pieces via custom-built digital platform. Subscribers select their products each month, wear them as often as they like, and then swap into new products the following month. Subscribers are also able to purchase the rented product. And menus and venues, quite different. The menus and venues division focuses on a dining experience that provides excellence in food, beverage, and service with 11 restaurants in the U.S. Think of what it takes to fund and manage all of those different segment businesses. You got to have a lot of different talent to do restaurants than you have to do weddings than you have to do bohemian style, contemporary style. So it requires some significant marketing management talent to make this happen, as well as, of course, resources. A subdivision here that I liked was Levi's Jeans, a different brand entirely. Broadly, at the broadest level, how do they segment? Well, we can say broadly they segment between men and women, right? So they have jeans for men, jeans for women. Within men, they have segments by fit, loose, regular, slim, boot cut, skinny, straight, tapered. You can buy it at places like Sears. That was a more serious thing in the old days, but they're still around. There were actually physical stores. So you can buy jeans for, I don't know, quo. These are the Sears and Roebuck jeans for $30, $18. I was hoping to come up with Levi's, which was a... So Levi's, so how many of you guys pay about, you know, $50, $60 for a pair of your jeans? That's about what you pay. Not that, well, let me back up. How many people wear jeans? Maybe that we're off at the wrong start. Most, well, if you aren't wearing jeans, then you aren't paying anything for it. So how many people pay less than that? Okay, how many people pay more than that? More than the $50, $60? A bunch of people aren't playing the game, but okay. So here we can get Levi jeans for the low, thank you, I'm a winner. For the low 50s, okay. You also can buy them at my favorite outlet, not my wife's, at my friend Kohl's. We can get, well, obviously I'm not going to work that hard at it. You can get jeans priced at about the same as you can at Sears. You also can buy Levi's jeans at Nordstrom. Now we're moving to my wife's territory. And we have Levi's jeans. Wait a minute, although I see we're on sale. $98, $98, $89. What happened to my nice low, okay, $89, not on sale. 80. Wait a minute, they're jeans. They're still Levi's jeans. Why are they $89 instead of the low 50s, which is what I try to explain to my wife all the time. Kohl's Levi's are pretty much the same as Nordstrom's Levi's. They're $40 cheaper. What are we doing? I deserve to shop at Nordstrom's. Okay, fine. So the product's the same. The distribution outlet is different. Women's jeans, by waist, at the waist, high rise, just below the waist, low rise, ultra low rise, skinny, straight cut, boot cut, flare, and trousers. Armani jeans are a thing. You would think that jeans might be jeans, but of course they're not. So Armani jeans, you can buy a pair, nice pair of jeans for, now we're talking, $500, yeah? How many people pay $500 for their jeans? Pikers, what's the matter with you? $500 pair of jeans. Jeans aren't jeans, right? They come in different, oh wait, I'm sorry, that was the low end. Let's move up to the $875 jeans. Oh, did we move to trousers? Slim fit, stretch denim jeans. Well, these do come with coordinating sunglasses, so that explains the difference. But here's our regular jeans at $495. Okay, what are we doing here? So True Religion jeans, also quite expensive, Neiman Marcus. So the article here, although it's underpriced since it's a while ago, but the question is, how can jeans cost $300? Or $1,200, because somebody will pay it.
Get the exact same thing for like $25 at Walmart.
I would not necessarily say the exact same thing,
obviously.
But pretty darn similar.
Yeah.
But there are segments that are willing to pay $1,200. Sorry, I'm losing you, for a pair of jeans. Also, we can take a different approach. Let's mass customize our jeans. Each person will get their own size jean. How many people have problems getting jeans that fit right? Bunch of people. Levi's, no, is it Levi's? Knows this, so you can make your own jeans, which is mass customization, right? The product built to your specs, like we talked about for Dell a while ago. Trying custom jeans for the first time guarantees the fit. You can get custom jeans, custom suits, custom pants. Here we have them for men. And we can get non-stretch, stretch, etc. And you can get the jean you want made to your size and shape for $69. Holy tamales. Here's one that's a little more upscale, made to your specs. Selvedge Works. Custom handcrafted denim. It's all about you. You choose your thread color, you choose your button, you choose the initials, etc., etc. And I don't know if you get, okay, so here we go. So these are a teeny bit more expensive because they're entirely custom, but they're in business. There's a segment that's willing to pay. You guys thought $1,200 was a lot. Actually, that's not dollars. I don't know what the hell that is. Anyhow, that's funny. So that's not dollars, but they're still willing to pay a lot of money for them. All right, a different segment. So the question becomes then, which segment are you in? Are you a Kohl's shopper, a Nordstrom shopper, an Armani shopper? Different segments want different things and are willing to pay different things. So over to, quite different than jeans, over to Mueller talking to us about Timken and how they're segmenting in their B2B world.
We've segmented markets in a lot of different ways. The way that we're focused on primarily today is by, I'll call it industry. And so our whole business is focused on, as an example, primary metals, wind energy, power generation, cement, automotive, off-highway construction vehicles. And so we kind of divide the market up by how our product gets used and in the kinds of equipment and applications our product gets used. And within those market segments, then we can divide up the market even further, and that's the real challenge of marketing, is this micro marketing or micro segmentation to really understand within off-highway construction, as an example, are there customers that demand short lead time production? Are there customers that need longer life? Are there customers that are looking for more productivity? And again, going down to that level and trying to develop products and service offerings around that is a real challenge. It's actually been a very big focus of the Timken Company since about 2004. We've had a strong focus on strengthening our marketing capabilities in those areas I just talked about.
So it's pretty easy to think about the categories at the high level. The trick is when you start driving down to your mission, your resources, your capability, your skill set, the customers you can serve, what he calls here micro-segmentation, what is it that you can do that differentiates you from the competition at that micro level beyond just the, we're talking about principles of marketing here, we're not digging down that far, beyond the gross, large divisions. What can you do that suits your mission and your resources? All right, back to the B2C world, Bayer Consumer Products. They employ 21,000 people worldwide. They're active in more than 100 countries, so global marketing. Sales, over 4 billion euros, more than 170 brands to manage worldwide. The consumer health headquarters is in Whippany, New Jersey. Bayer Consumer Health's over-the-counter brands are manufactured around the globe in Europe, North America, Latin America, and Asia, so a bit of supply chain stuff embedded there. So they have five major segments within their consumer care strategic business unit. Analgesics, so we do know Bayer Aspirin and Aleve and Actrin and Midol. Gastrointestinal brands such as Alka-Seltzer, Lefax, Philip Milk of Magnesia, Rennie and Talcid. Dermatological products such as Benfenthal and Canesten. cough and cold remedies, Alka-Seltzer Plus, Aleve Cold and Sinus and Tapsin. And multivitamins and dietary supplements. Baroka, One A Day, Flintstones, Complete Gummies, plus My First Flintstones. Who had Flintstones vitamins when you were growing up? There you go. You were consumers of Bayer products in that particular segment. Hey, what, huh? They're so good? Well, you can probably still buy them. They'll sell them to you. Now, let's break this down within aspirin. Let's see what their two major segments are. Aspirin regimen and aspirin for pain relief. Anybody know off the top of their head what aspirin regimen is for?
I used to remember what it was.
You know? So if you've had a heart attack, they want you to keep your blood thin. And so you're on a regular dose, low dose of aspirin, which keeps your blood thin. And that's aspirin regimen. So there are two segments here that they talk about. In fact, there's a funny commercial, which I couldn't find, but it was a while ago, where there's a guy on an airplane, and he says to the steward, flight attendant, he says, do you have any aspirin? And the guy looks real concerned. Are you having a heart attack? He says, no, back pain. So the point is they may have overemphasized this regimen for heart attacks and perhaps forgotten that they're also good there for back pain relief, for pain relief as well. Anyhow, so here's the aspirin regimen to reduce recurrent heart attacks and strokes brands. So we have Bayer low dose, Bayer chewable in, I don't know what that is, cherry, orange, women's calcium regimen products, sugar-free Bayer, Bayer safety coated, and Bayer with Heart Advantage. Did I find that commercial?
I had a heart problem. I was told to begin my aspirin regimen. I just didn't listen until I almost lost my life. My doctors, again, ordered me to take aspirin, and I do.
Be sure to talk to your doctor before you begin an aspirin regimen.
Listen to the doctor. Take it seriously.
So obviously we're targeting here a particular segment, that segment that's going to take aspirin to help reduce heart attacks and stroke, and we're not focused on pain because that's not what this segment is. Here's the Bayer Aspirin, Aspirin for Pain Relief, a different segment. Back and body pain, Bayer Plus, Bayer the Wonder Drug, Bayer Extra Strength, Bayer PM.
And... body pain? Oh. Back pain? Try Bayer Back and Body. It's Bayer Aspirin plus a special pain relief booster to relieve sore backs and soothe aching muscles fast. Get moving again with Bayer Back and Body.
So we can pretty well see a difference between those two ads, who they're targeting, what the benefits are, why you would buy it. They're using the appropriate promotion. Now, maybe this is where I got the, maybe I did find that ad.
Do you have something for pain?
I have Bayer Aspirin.
I'm not having a heart attack. It's my back.
I mean Bayer Back and Body. It works great for pain.
Bayer Back and Body provides effective relief for your tough pain.
Better?
Yeah. Thanks for the tip.
So trying to get around this issue of, well, which one are we talking about? Because we have both. So let's think about selecting a target market. Before selecting a target market strategy, we must have to determine the desirability of each of those segments that we most might focus on. First of all, is the segment's needs compatible with our goals? I think I used a long time ago the example of Patagonia. Good for the world, taking care of the environment. Somebody comes up with a great idea about a piton that blasts into the rocks. It'd be really easy to use. And we say, it might be easy to use, but it's not good for the environment. We're not going for that segment. It's not us. So do we want to sell alcohol? Do we want to avoid selling to discounters like Walmart? Is this segment that we're thinking about compatible with our goals? Is there a match between the market opportunity and our resources? So we discover that, indeed, there is a market for solar-powered lawnmowers, but we have no skill in solar power. It's not going to work. We don't, you know, there's nothing going on there. It doesn't make sense. It's not a good opportunity for us. Black & Decker bought General Electric's small appliance business, and there was a question of how should they market, where should they market their new small appliances, because that is not the business they were in. They were in tools. And one question was, should they continue the GE name or should they call it Black & Decker, because that isn't small appliances what they were used to. They did go with Black & Decker, so you can get a Black & Decker coffee pot. And they decided to, suddenly start offering it in places they knew well. So their tools were always sold in the Home Depot. Now you can get their appliances in the Home Depot, as well as from a variety of other stores, as they decided how to reach that segment with their new brand. Also, since we're in business, are you going to get a profit? Are you going to get a profit out of this segment that justifies the investment? Your investment may not be $100 million, but it's significant. I'm not so concerned you're watching the cat videos, but could you cover your face for me? Thanks. So the segment has to be large enough. The segment should be expected to grow. This is probably not a great time to develop a brand new marketing mix for CD players. Not really a growth market. We need to be able to reach the segment at a reasonable cost, both physically and with our promotion, right? So our distribution and our promotion has to be able to get to this segment. So these are some criteria you want to apply as you think about, is it worth targeting these folks? Now, this is a while ago, and then we'll update a little bit. Webvan was an online credit and delivery grocery business that went bankrupt back in, That's okay. I got some Stoli here. I mean water. Can you believe it that somebody beat me up one time joking about drinking vodka? They said, there are alcoholics in your audience, recovering alcoholics. Don't joke about alcohol. So I apologize. It's water. It's water. All right, we good? Um, So Webvan, back in the dot-com days, the big days of coming up online, they were operating in 10 U.S. markets. Webvan delivered products to customers' homes within a 30-minute window of their choosing, and they had hoped to open in 26 cities. Now, this was not associated with an existing grocery store business. So they were going to set this up with their own warehouses, fully stocked with whatever their customers were going to order, so they had to have inventory there, within 30 minutes of your home. What sounds like a good idea to start wasn't really such a good idea. CNET hailed Webvan as one of the greatest dot-com disasters in history. What happened? Well, the cost of processing, fulfilling, and delivery of these products within 30 minutes of your home was $500 million. This is a startup company. So, realistically, they could not reach their target consumer with their promise as it was built out. So, here was Webvan failing. They just couldn't have enough warehouses nearby. Now, of course, things change, and we do have an updated version of the failed concept. Not all marketing ideas work. So we know DoorDash expanded so that consumers can now order groceries on demand from their local Southeastern grocers, delivered in as little as 45 minutes through DoorDash's marketplace app and website. Uber Connect now is available in 6,000 cities and towns in the U.S., and there are a host of instant delivery startups, Joker, Buck, 1520, Fridge No More, Gorillas, Get Deer, promise extra fast convenience store style products directly to city dwellers' doors. The companies say orders will arrive in 30, 20, 15, or even 10 minutes after the customers hit the buy button on their apps. But it's a different setup. They are not trying to run their own grocery business because they just can't do it. All right, competitors are few or weak. We've already talked about the lack of wisdom in your small new business going head-to-head with major competition. So having segmented the market into various groups, analyze them to determine which and how many of these to target with appropriate marketing mixes, we now need to think about how to position our brand for our target audience. Segmentation, dividing the population, the market up into different types that have different needs, wants, and desires from one another. Targeting, thinking about one or more of those that we can focus on with our marketing mix to make a profit successfully. Positioning, how are we going to get our brand image built in the mind of those consumers? So positioning the product is the idea of creating and maintaining in the minds of target market consumers a particular image relative to the competition. Positioning. If I asked you to think about Walmart, does an image of a Walmart store and what they do come to mind? Do you have an image of Walmart? They have a pretty good position. You aren't going, Walmart, well, there's sort of this. And so I pretty much know what a Walmart is. And if you've ever shopped Nordstrom's, I ask you to think of Nordstrom's. Does an image of that come to mind? Is it the same one as Walmart? No, they're different. Obviously, they're in somewhat different categories as well. But still, they have different images in the mind of the consumer. So this is the idea of getting this going. Anybody like Sensodyne for sensitive teeth? Man, when I use, sometimes my wife will buy the wrong toothpaste and I don't pay attention. I use it. Ow! My gums hurt. My teeth hurt. Sensodyne has a particular target market that it has positioned itself well for. Sensodyne toothpaste, the name Sensodyne suggests the benefits that it provides, which is for sensitive teeth. The ads suggest the benefits, and the fact that its dentist recommends means, of course, it's got some credibility to it.
The sensitivity, they want to get rid of it. They want to be out of pain. There's no reason to put up with the pain of tooth sensitivity. I recommend Sensodyne to my patients. Sensodyne helps with the sensitivity, plus it's great for fighting cavities. It freshens your breath. With proper brushing, it can help with your gum health. Sensodyne is definitely at the top of my list. It works, and it always delivers, and my outcomes are always good. What a difference that makes.
At its core, it's still a toothpaste. It still has to clean teeth and prevent cavities. Otherwise, it's not really a toothpaste, but it has this extra added benefit of being good for sensitive teeth. So they've done a good job of positioning this brand for the consumer. So consumers often form mental images to help them simplify their decision-making. What product am I going to get? That one. And we want to help them to do that by creating really nice, strong positioning brand image for our product. So there are three steps in product positioning. First of all, decide what your positioning concept is going to be. What's it going to be? Well, it's something that's important to the consumer. Good for sensitive teeth. Doesn't hurt your mouth. Okay, that's something that would be important to those who have that need. Ask yourself, what will you do for me that other companies or products will not do? In this case, help sensitive teeth. In another category, Dove recognized that many people complained that soap left their skin feeling dry. So Dove says, hey, we contain 1/4 pure moisturizing cream and mild cleansers to leave your skin soft and smooth. Soap, that nasty soap, on the other hand, contains drying ingredients that strip the skin of its natural moisturizer, leaving it feel tight and dry.
We offered women a mystery beauty treatment.
Right now? Yeah, that sounds great.
Could they guess what it was?
Very rich and smooth, really creamy.
I keep touching my face.
So, what had we used?
What?
Wait!
Just water was added to this? My skin definitely feels much more radiant.
That sense of having, like, smooth, dewy skin.
Only Dove has 1/4 moisturizing cream for smoother, more radiant skin. Dove, your daily beauty treatment for radiant skin.
So there we're positioning our brand. There we're building an image in the mind of the consumer. When they think Dove, we want them to think this rich cleansing cream, moisturizing cream product. All right, then design the features that will convey whatever that position is. Right? So 1/4 pure moisturizing cream, a product that actually doesn't hurt your teeth when you use it. What are the features that will convey that position to the brand? Done well, this then embodies your unique selling proposition, USP. What's the unique selling proposition? The thing that makes you different than the competition, that causes your target audience to want to buy you. Oh yeah, your USP differentiates your product from the competition's on a feature or features that are key to the consumer. So, might be the lowest cost, the highest quality, being innovative, the first ever product of its kind. How many of you guys like to buy in a different category? It doesn't matter. The first thing, the new one out, whatever the it is that you like. Anybody? Innovators? You like the new one? We have a very small audience of innovators, okay? Just you. All right, so you like the new stuff. That might appeal to you because it's the new whatever. A unique selling proposition can be thought of as what you have, the competitors don't have, that is of importance to your target audience, to your consumers. And you know that because you've done the research, you know who they are, their needs, wants, and desires, you know what the competition is offering, and what you're going to do that's special. So you're designing the features that convey your product position to the consumer. And then you can coordinate all the elements of the marketing mix to convey that position. Your channel distribution, your packaging, your promotion, your pricing, your product features, etc. So Target, for a while, had the position of expect more, pay less, sort of their position. The USP score, the toughest job you'll ever love, as a product position for a not-for-profit organization. M&M's, melts in your mouth, not in your hand. FedEx, the world on time, and when it absolutely, positively has to get there overnight. Bounty, the quicker picker-upper. So these are the taglines that suggest the positioning statement for those brands, yeah? So what does your target audience want? What can you do that's different than the competition that's important to them? How are you going to make it, build it into your marketing mix to convey it to those consumers? Kay Jewelers, how many people know Kay? Anybody know their tagline? Every kiss begins with K, sort of a positioning statement as opposed to pure luxury or whatever.
What's that? You got mommy a Mother's Day present? From where?
Oh, nice. Oh, I totally agree. She's the best mommy ever.
It's beautiful. Dad, what's that? Give daddy a great big kiss.
Every kiss begins with kiss.
Aw, and so a bit of their commercial to deliver their position for this particular segment of the market. Now, sometimes things change and we have to reposition our brand, change the image that we have in the marketplace due to changing factors. Victoria's Secret is the largest lingerie retailer in the U.S. and has been for several decades. So their total revenue in 2019 was $7.5 billion. It achieved explosive success in the late 90s and 2000s, but it has been accused of losing relevance in recent years. Its 2020 revenues were $5.4 billion. So we would say that there are other things going on too, but there's also changing social norms relative to this product category. The company is currently overhauling its brand image and has abandoned its angels for activists and entrepreneurs. So we're repositioning a brand in the minds of the consumers. 1977, the brand was created by Roy Raymond as a place where men would feel comfortable shopping for women for lingerie for women. The story was he went into a lingerie store with his wife. It was all girly and frilly, and it was, he just felt very uncomfortable. So he wanted a more comfortable environment to shop for men to shop for lingerie for their women. June 1982, Les Wexner, founder of Al Brands, acquired Victoria's Secret 6 stores and its catalog for $1 million. So we see a strategy of growth through acquisition. He turned Raymond's vision on its head and created a store that was focused on women rather than men. So that was an initial repositioning of the brand. This repositioning worked. By the early 1990s, Victoria's Secret had become the largest lingerie retailer in the U.S., with 350 stores nationally, sales topping $1 billion. Seems like that worked pretty well. 1997, the Victoria's Secret Angel concept. They had runway shows. They were growing in success. 2006 to 15, during CEO Sharon Jester Turney's tenure, the company thrived. Sales increased by 70% to $7.7 billion. Between 15 and 18, sales began to falter. Its market share in the U.S. dropped from 33% to 24%. Victoria's Secret was slow to adjust to a shift from padded and push-up bras towards bralettes and sports bras, missing out on a major fashion trend. People, what do I tell you? Pay attention to those external factors, those changing social norms, what they mean for your consumers, because they're going to affect your business. Have I not said that? They weren't. So here's the importance of tracking and adapting to changes in consumers' needs, wants, desires, and changing social norms. Competition steps in. If you're not satisfying a segment, their needs, wants, and desires, as well as you could or should, somebody else is going to come and say, I can do that better than you are. I'll take that market share. Thank you. So more body-positive underwear brands such as Aerie, Third Love, and Lively cropped up, taking market share. That's not making share, taking market share. So the competition is always willing to serve the consumer better than you are doing, can do, or want to do, brought to life. So the current rebrand. In March 2019, an activist shareholder called out the company's brand image as being outdated. Victoria's Secret brand image is starting to appear to many as being outdated and even a bit of tone deaf by failing to be aligned with women's evolving attitudes towards beauty, diversity, and inclusion. What a perfect example for International Women's Day. It seems Victoria's Secret took this criticism to heart. It appointed two new female board directors, Siri Nash and Ishihan, and made steps to address the comments about the brand image being outdated. It hired a more body-inclusive model, Hungarian model Barbara Palvin, and also hired its first openly transgender model, Brazilian transgender model Valentina Sampio, so celebrities in their promotion. In the second half of 2020, the brand started to recover, boosted by more sales online. Jefferies analyst described Victoria's Secret progress as admirable after reported strong fourth quarter results early in 2021. So here's the impact of changing strategies and doing a rebrand. It's also taken steps to overhaul the brand image again, most recently swapping its angels for a new group of activists and entrepreneurial women to be the face of the brand, including the likes of soccer star Megan Rapinoe. Say that for me. Yeah, what you said. And body advocate Paloma Elsia. Retail experts say the news is a step in the right direction, but success depends on how Victoria's Secret utilizes its new partners. In addition, the brand may struggle to regain lost ground from competitors that have long promoted body positivity. You don't want to lose your consumer to the competition, because then you got to win them back. The notion of celebrating women's bodies with realistic spokespeople like, I should be able to say that. Like Rapinoe, is a departure from the over-sexualized marketing Victoria's Secret has promoted in the past. So we're repositioning the brand, we're using celebrity spokespersons to help reposition the brand and build a new brand image in the marketplace. Dropping the ball really gave other brands the opportunity to move in. Their biggest competitor is Aerie at American Eagle. They're the ones who really pioneered the body positivity movement. The new faces linked to Victoria's Secret are what shoppers and younger generations especially want to see in advertising. They're very relatable. It's not aspirational, who I might want to look like. You can see yourself in that individual representing the brand, whereas before it was that's what I aspire to be, and I have to go on a diet for a year to even look that way. Now the younger generation really wants to see themselves reflected in the marketing of companies whose clothes they wear. So stay tuned. We'll have to see the results of the rebranding. But this is rebranding to readjust to the changing social norms of your consumers. If you think about how you're going to position your product, you certainly have to look at the competition. So this is a simplification of a tool called a perceptual map. You decide through your research on the important attributes, characteristics that consumers look for in this particular market. In this case, the two important characteristics are amount of service, limited to extensive, and fashionability, from traditional to fashion forward. And what do we see? Well, we see over here on the right-hand side that up in the area of fashion forward, extensive service, it's pretty crowded. Neiman Marcus, Saks Fifth Avenue, Bloomingdale's, Nordstrom. Then we see down in the lower left-hand side where we have traditional style with limited service, Walmart. So we have a bunch of unoccupied positions. Then we start head scratching. We probably don't want to try to be a new fashion-forward extensive service retailer. I don't think that's going to be great for you. Are there markets that are underserved? So with your target audience in mind, select a positioning concept that's valuable to them and that differentiates you from the competition. Does your target audience think that fashion-forward with less service could be a good idea? What about somewhat traditional with moderate service? Are those possibilities? Using this perceptual map to avoid the competition. Then design the dimension or features that most effectively convey your position. How do you communicate that with your brand name or whatever? And then coordinate the marketing mix components to convey a consistent position. All of the marketing mix elements should complement that intended position. So perceptual map lets us see where the competition is, see where the gaps are, and begin to ask ourselves, is there an opportunity for us there? In order to make this work, it does assume that all the segmentation criteria we've talked about are met. No point going in if you can't make a profit. So what are some positioning errors that we can make that we see? Well, one is under-positioning. Under-positioning means the consumer doesn't really know what the heck you are. They're vague. Okay? So Crystal Pepsi, as I described before, Crystal Pepsi was the idea of a clear product. It was Pepsi-Cola tasting. It was Pepsi-Cola in a clear product. When you drank it, it was suddenly Pepsi in your mouth, water. It looked like water. What is that, and why would I want it? For a while, KFC lost its way. What was KFC's original name? Kentucky Fried Chicken. And then they went away from their name. Why? Why? Easy to remember, shorter. Okay, why else? Not? No, it was always chicken. Say again? It wasn't fried. No, it was always fried. It was always chicken. So no problems there. There were social changes for dietary things. Fried was bad. People didn't want to think about it being fried. It was always fried. It was always chicken. But people didn't want to think. So they moved to KFC. But now, what are you if you're not Kentucky Fried Chicken? Now what are you? They lost their way. Most recently, of course, and then they dropped the colonel. Then most recently, they brought the colonel back with a lot of humor and a lot of different actors portraying the colonel, coming back towards the idea of Kentucky Fried Chicken. But what are you? That's not good. Consumers don't know what you are. They're going to go to the competition where they know what they're getting. Sometimes we can overposition. Here, we give buyers too narrow a picture of the company. How many of you would like to either get or give? Ignore it. What is that? Great. Great. I don't know what that is. Well, that's pretty annoying. Say again? Can I mute it? Yeah, we'll see. Nope. All right, I don't know what that buzz is, so I'm going to ignore it, even though it's going to be on the recording. How many of you guys would like to either get or give, ignoring the price, but the concept, Tiffany jewelry? Tiffany? Okay. How many of you guys have actually gotten or given Tiffany? There's a smaller subset there that raised their hand. What do we think a ring at Tiffany might cost? 300? More? More than 300? More than 1,000? Maybe around there? No. We'll see. What is the image of the Tiffany? How much is a ring going to be? How much can we spend? And the problem is, many folks feel that Tiffany is just going to be too expensive. I can't go out and afford $500, $600, $700, $800. Well, of course, it turns out that you're able to get products. Can I sort here on price? Well, and under, so here's $250. How about a nice thing from Tiffany's in their little blue box, right? For $250. Now, of course, there is the other side of things. Well, for example, where'd it go? For example, so certainly that's what many people would think of when they think of Tiffany. So here we've got the $6,500 one, the $10,000. Now we're talking $15,000. But the point is, because for most people, they picture Tiffany as being more in that domain, they don't even think about scraping together the $250, which isn't nothing, but still, to make that special gift for a special person in the little blue box. They may have overpositioned. They may have moved themselves out of a market where they might draw people in on the lower price gifts. Or confused positioning. So here we're going to claim two or more contradicting benefits, or we're going to change our positions often, and the point is that consumers can't figure out who we are. If their mental image of us is confused, why would they buy us? Buy a competition that has something that's a unique selling proposition that appeals to them. Done a better job of positioning the brand. Velveeta. What's Velveeta? It's a cheese, but for a long time people couldn't figure out, was it for cooking? Was it for eating? Was it for snacking? Well, obviously eating, but what was it for? They were confused. Velveeta dealt with that a little bit by coming up with a series of recipes for holiday meals that included Velveeta for snacks. So you could see what it was. So here's some basic positioning platforms that you might consider using. A premium position, status symbol. So this would be Maserati, okay. A bit of a status position. You don't find one in every town around. Stuart Hughes is a special designer for very wealthy people. Value for money, still a car, but not a Maserati. So here's the best subcompact cars for 2022, the Hyundai Accent at a mere under $20,000. Yeah, well. What else we got? Value for money, friend or family, values are worth. Fashions is a grocery store in a particular town who focuses on family worth. Being a problem solver, IBM is solving problems for your business. They no longer focus on the idea of the hardware that they sell. Fun, Disney. Trendy or stylish, Oscar de la Renta or Zara. Being a role model or liability, trust, quality, premium, celebrity endorsements, anti-establishment, you could be a rebel, technological leader in innovation, HP Labs, a service leader, or of course, we can combine some of these basic positioning platforms together. So for example, Disney is family and fun, all combined together, right? So we can mix these guys up and mix them together. So that is segmentation, targeting, positioning, SDP, that's the end, and it's a key marketing framework. Have a good day.